The Black Show Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio, where you listen with your ears and not your mouth.
Good evening and welcome to the Black Show Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio. You are in the studio tonight with myself, Aisha, and Ellie is joining me.
Hello.
And Matt Boothman's here.
Hello.
So this week on the show, we have got quite a long interview that Ellie, you did with Lizzie Cooper.
Delightfully long interview.
She is a friend of Blackshaw. She does a lot of work with us, doesn't she?
Yeah, absolutely. She's stage manager extraordinaire, which for people who don't know what a stage manager is, stay tuned and listen to the interview.
Yes, this is one of those interviews where you get to learn something about the theatre world that you might not actually know if you don't know what a stage manager is. So we'll be playing that shortly. And we're also going to be talking about what we've seen recently. Yep. Matt, you've seen some stuff.
I've seen a couple of national shows since we were last in the studio.
Yes, and I was banging on about seeing Matilda a couple of weeks ago, and I went and saw that, and it was crazy good.
I'm so glad you loved it.
Children. Just the children.
They're so talented.
Oh, just, yeah.
They show up the rest of the West End and the terrible child actors that managed to make it onto big stages.
Really?
Yeah.
I've never seen a show with so many kids in it, and it blew my mind. Mm-hmm. But we'll talk about that in a little bit. But the first thing that we always do on the show is this.
The Matt Boothman Film Review. So good, I put my trousers back on.
Matt, what are you going to be reviewing in the world of film today?
We're going to be talking Ghostbusters. I don't think we've licensed that music.
Does it count if I sing it?
Let's not take the risk.
I think it's fine.
You can all sing it in your heads at home.
So I actually did this time what I've been threatening to do almost since we started doing the show, which is actually put out some polls.
Oh yes, I saw that
on Facebook about what I should go and see, because I've seen a fair few shows in the last couple of weeks. So I needed some guidance on what to review, and Ghostbusters was the overwhelming winner.
Really?
Everybody wants to hear about the Ghostbusters.
Yeah, I voted, but only once.
That's very reasonable of you, Ellie.
I thought it would be fair.
Yeah. You've seen it as well, right?
Yes.
And did you vote after seeing it or before?
I voted after seeing it.
Okay, so you saw it and decided, I want to talk about this on the radio.
Yeah, and I thought, I want to know what Matt thinks of this.
Yeah. So, right. So the setup, if you've been living under a rock and haven't heard anything about this yet, it is a reboot of Ghostbusters, which was a sort of classic movie franchise and has sort of gone cross-media. There were a couple of movies, there were some TV shows, there were some games, etc. Mm-hmm. And it's now been relaunched by Paul Feig, the guy who did Bridesmaids, with an all-new cast and completely restarting from scratch. And isn't it nice to be able to talk about a movie and not have to say there are no women in it this time?
Yes, a great relief to us all.
But this one's sort of gone the other end of the spectrum though, hasn't it? It's gone like, everyone's like, why is there so many women in this film? And like talking to Kristen Wiig, they're like, oh, you know, how was it making a film that's really different? And she's just like, oh my God, why are we still talking about this? Yeah.
And it's, so what they've done is where in the original two Ghostbusters movies, it was about a team of four Ghostbusters, all of whom were dudes. This time it's a team of four Ghostbusters, all of whom are ladies. We have balance in the universe.
Represent.
Yeah. Also have cast from sort of the current crop of Saturday Night Live comedian people. Mm-hmm. And generally Paul Feig's sort of preferred actors who he's worked with before in Bridesmaids and that sort of thing. So Melissa McCarthy and Kristen Wiig were both in that.
Yeah, and I think he did Spy, which Melissa McCarthy starred in as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Which I missed in the cinemas, but I keep hearing now is really good.
Oh, it's very funny.
Yeah. So this version of Ghostbusters is, it's in dialogue with the previous movies. Mm. And I think it even gets some stuff right that those movies didn't.
Interesting.
You know, it's in dialogue with them in that it constantly references them. The general shape of the story is about the same.
They're busting ghosts.
Mm-hmm. There's a giant ghost at the end. Everything is sort of vaguely similar.
It's not Stay Puft, though, is it?
No, it's not. That's but there is a reference
there is
to
a,
that.
There's a, yes.
Of course there is. He's my favourite character.
Yeah.
There's a lot of callbacks, which I think is really rewarding for fans of the original.
Yeah, so callbacks and like teases of the famous quotable lines, where so, you know, that thing where somebody will nearly say the line but not quite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and pretty much all the original Ghostbusters from that the older movies are in it in cameo.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really? That's fun.
Even Harold Ramis, who's dead.
Yes.
How? What kind of magic is that? Is it just him on telly? Like, no. In the original film?
Well, no. You'll have to watch it and try and support him.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's sort of, it's self-aware in that it's aware of itself being a reboot and being related to those movies. It also seems to be, to me, very self-aware and in dialogue with its own context. And I don't know, because obviously the movie production timeline is very, very long. So I don't know when they were originally scripting this or improvising it or so on, what if they had any sense of what the internet's reaction to an all-lady Ghostbusters reboot was going to be.
Right.
But the movie is pretty much, like, thematically, and it's basically a knockabout comedy and it doesn't have lots of very deep themes. But if you were to sort of analyse it and work out what the themes are, it's about being sort of ridiculed for your beliefs or for who you are.
Mm-hmm.
So the good guys are people who... So Kristen Wiig's character saw ghosts as a child and was bullied for it and found a friend in Melissa McCarthy's character, and that's how their friendship came to be. And so they sort of... So she's ridiculed for something and sort of finds a friend and finds strength in it and sort of says, why do I have to care what these people think of me, is kind of the ultimate... response to that.
Sure.
Whereas the bad guy of the movie is somebody who is ridiculed by everybody and sees himself as a bullied outsider in the same way, but responds to it by deciding to bully everybody else and destroy the world.
Okay, so that's the bad guy's motive end world.
Pretty much,
As recompense for the bad treatment he has received.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a feasible task to you know.
In a universe where there are ghosts and ley lines that you can use for that purpose. But he basically stands in for all the whiny people on the internet who've been like, this movie's going to destroy my childhood.
Oh,
and who have been sort of saying, you know, doing everything that they can to make the movie tank or to convince people not to go and see it because they don't like it for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that thing of they see themselves as sort of the bullied geeks who then turn around and turn that into anger and hatred of things. So that is the movie's antagonist. And then the good guys are the ones who sort of say, well, we don't care what people think. We just sort of, we are strong in ourselves.
Yeah, and there's a really strong related link of friendship and the unity of the Ghostbusters team.
Okay.
Yeah. So that makes it sound very heavy, and it is not. It is a...
So not. I mean, you did really well to eke that out there.
like I'm sort of digging a little bit to get to that, but, you know, I thought it was worth talking about.
It's true.
Yeah. So while it's references the original Ghostbusters, it still is very much its own thing. It's not like this current crop are sort of versions of the four original ones.
Yeah, that's what I'm interested in. Like, how separated out is it?
They are completely brand new crop of characters.
Yeah, it's not a remake in that sense. Mm-hmm. It's a reboot.
That's
good.
Yeah.
And they are characters that I kind of instantly fell in love with, all of them.
Yeah.
Especially, so the one that whose name you'll have heard a lot is Kate McKinnon, who is fresh off Saturday Night Live. I have never seen her in anything else before. So she plays kind of the mad scientist engineer character who comes up with all their ghost hunting gear.
Sure.
And I don't know, Ellie, what did you think of...
I love her.
Holtzman.
She's my spirit animal.
How so?
She's just, I think, she's this very strong character. It's great to see a woman being an engineer. And but she's so off the wall. And she just comes out with what seems like, I think, quite abrupt humour at first.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as an audience member, you do what... lead lady.
Kristen Wiig.
Thank you. Kristen Wiig's character does, which is to kind of recoil and be like, oh, you're weird. Why are you weird? You're so weird. And then after a couple of those weirdnesses, you're like, oh, I like this. I embrace this. This is brilliant. And you figure out pretty quickly that she's actually a comic genius.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And then there's the fourth one. Who's the...
So Leslie Jones.
Sure. She's Saturday Night Live as well?
I don't actually know where she's come from.
I think she is.
Probably. I think they're pretty much all SNL people. So she's the only one who isn't a scientist of the four, but she's like a New York folk historian. So she supplies all this knowledge that they like. So they are two theoretical physicists and an engineer, and she is the historian who gives them all the knowledge that they need about hauntings that they didn't have at first.
I see.
So she knows all of the history of the city, basically.
Fair enough. Yeah. So she knows who the ghosts are?
She knows about like different buildings, and so they can kind of make educated guesses based on her knowledge of the history of the building as to who the ghost might be or why they might be there or where they are.
Sure. Yeah. To be honest, I can't actually remember Ghostbusters, the first one, very well at all. I think the last time that we saw it was at a holiday.
Yeah.
We were all on together and I fell asleep.
Yeah. Well, it was the end of a long day.
It was a very long day. Yeah.
But I definitely want to go back and rewatch the original two films as a result of seeing.
Oh, really?
The
That's new interesting.
One. Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, I think, like Matt says, they're not trying to recreate the same characters, so it very much feels like they're kind of in the same universe, but it's a different story.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really good, you know, they form a good team dynamic, and they're sort of interesting to watch, just bounce off each other for comedic purposes, but also like they all have complementary strengths that work to sort of drive the plot forward as well.
Yeah.
So, works on every level.
And I think, like, with all the press and stuff and people coming out and being like, why is it just all females? I think, you know, that question is somewhat valid, I suppose, but it is nice to have, a foursome of women who really are captivating on screen.
Yeah.
That's fun.
Yeah.
We don't get that often, so I don't think that we should complain too much about it.
It definitely passes the Bechdel test.
Definitely.
Yay. Yeah. Oh no, if it didn't, then that would be concerning. There would be
all they talk about is men.
It would have been a silent film. I feel like we're talking a lot this year about reboots. Is that right of me saying that? Or
they get made a lot because they are seen as safe bets by studio money people.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, yeah, I know what that is. I know that it has an audience who already know that they like it. Like, I don't have to work too hard to market this. I can just say, it's like this thing that you already like.
Yeah, it's very marketable.
They're easy to finance.
And also, most Hollywood producers are only going for things that could be franchised now. So if it's a reboot of something, it's a pretty safe bet that it can be sequeled.
Mm.
And that's what they want. They want, you know, to sign a cast for two or three movies at a time.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess, like, the other one which you've seen is Star Trek, which is out now.
Yeah.
Because
great example of a franchise reboot. Yeah.
It's got a great following already.
Mm.
The market's there. Make a film about it.
Exactly.
You'll make a ton of money. It's very smart, but
it is.
Not sure if I agree with it.
It probably means that more kind of independent standalone films are obviously getting turned down as a result.
Yeah.
So that is a shame.
Yeah.
But yeah, Ghostbusters is fantastic.
Yeah.
Yes,
digging around, the only criticism I could really come up with for it is there are a few bits where it's edited a bit choppily and weirdly. Like
That's digging deep, man,
it
I feel.
Is, but it is a bit of a distraction when it happens. There are scenes where it feels like there's, you know, only sort of 2 or 5 second bits missing, but just sort of important stepping stones that you need to get you from one thing to another.
Right.
And without them, it jars.
Okay.
Because you spend a second being like, how did they? Yeah. Oh, right.
Wait,
okay.
I thought that person was over there.
Yeah.
And like, did you notice the bad guy's sideburns change?
Yes.
There was a continuity issue.
Really?
So, you know. Mm. If I have criticisms, it's with the director, editor.
Never
We haven't even talked about Chris Hemsworth, who is in it.
Yes!
The bimbo receptionist.
Yeah.
Bimbo beefcake.
I've really enjoyed the internet comments about that. There's people who are genuinely outraged that there would be a male character in it who is being used as eye candy only and portrayed as really dumb. It's like, oh yeah, that must really sting. How sad for you that your gender is being portrayed in such a negative way.
One time, ever. Yeah.
But, you know, it's really, he's puts in a brilliant performance, actually. As a supporting artist, he's very rewarding to watch.
I had no idea he was in it until you guys told me that. And in his native tongue, which is very exciting for me, because I feel like, I'm not sure if people know that he's Australian.
No, most people assume he's American.
Yeah, and then you hear that accent and you're like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
Did you get more attractive or less attractive? I'm not really sure anymore.
You'll have to watch it and tell us what happened to his attractiveness rating.
Yeah, I don't know. I wonder if he's hamming his accent up. He probably is.
I think he's just doing his normal voice.
Yeah?
Yeah. And I think I was just really impressed with, like I was saying to Matt earlier, I know in the context of using SNL cast and the director, they use a lot of impro in their improvisation in their filming. And he really like holds his own against big comedy acts. So,
weren't you saying that the cast was saying he's a really funny guy?
Yeah.
And I get that.
Yeah, like, Melissa McCarthy was pretty upset that he is just constantly revealing new talents and failing to produce anything that is below brilliant. So she was being interviewed on Graham Norton saying that she was just holding out hope he was a terrible singer. Mm. And then he sang on set and she was like, oh, he's brilliant at that as well.
Oh, no.
Interesting, actually, like in terms of the ensemble dynamic and how it sort of works with the humour, that I feel like Kristen Wiig and Melissa McCarthy were maybe reined in a bit, and they're almost playing like the straight man.
Mm. Oh, really?
Yeah, well, they're playing scientists who have an established friendship, and they're kind of having to play that kind of straight narrative role around which all the insanity revolves.
Yeah,
a lot
and Kristen
of time.
Wiig is actually like the buttoned-down character with all the dignity to lose, who obviously keeps getting slimed and all that.
Yeah.
But because those two are a bit more restrained than we've seen them in potentially in other roles, it means that the slightly more wacky performances like Kate McKinnon's and like Chris Hemsworth's
can
really fly off the chain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and really shine. Yeah, and I think that whether that was an ensemble or a directorial or an everyone decision, brilliant.
Yeah,
really
you've got to be able to do that and make those choices, I think. Otherwise, you've just got a movie that's a complete ramshackle mess.
And I suppose it's partly because there's not usually kind of actually having four lead characters is quite a lot.
Yeah. Mm.
Usually you have two comedy leads.
Yeah, you don't want them fighting too much.
I think it just kind of goes to show what experienced team players they are in terms of comedy and improvisation.
Yeah, it's like sports. It's like they're just like sort of like on the bench for a bit. Like, being like, you can take this funny
but
gag.
But it's also
now.
Like sports as in like they're all top of their game. They are the athletes of comedy. I found that really fun to watch someone just doing something they're brilliant at.
Yeah. Oh, SNL is just breeding the best kind of people, and it has been doing for, you know, the last...
It can go wrong in movies, though. There are a lot of...
That's true.
A lot of the people who sort of come out of that SNL stable, I find a lot of their movies quite tiresome because it's all this sort of part improv'd directorial or production style.
Mm.
And it's when they, rather than some people saying, I'm going to take the straight role, I'm going to rein myself in a bit, when they're all just competing with each other instead and all trying to be the wackiest and get the biggest laugh, then it becomes quite grating. Whereas I think the balance is done really well in Ghostbusters.
Yeah. So Matt, what might you be doing in the next couple of weeks?
I will probably do Suicide Squad next.
Oh, yeah. I forgot that's coming out.
Yeah.
I keep seeing the fantastic posters everywhere.
Yeah. Which looks like it might be the beginning of... the DC Comics movie... Obviously, we've got this DC Comics movies, Marvel Comics movies...
Sort
of going head-to-head in the box office. And the last couple of DC Comics ones have been sort of unrelentingly dour and a bit dull and not very interesting.
Yeah.
Which ones are those? Is that Batman versus Superman?
Yeah. And Man of Steel before it, which was...
Oh, so boring.
Just very grey.
Yeah.
Just super grey.
No one cares about Superman is the worst. Yeah. He sucks.
Whereas now it seems like Suicide Squad looks much more wacky and fun if the trailer is anything to go by, and they've been releasing some new stuff at San Diego Comic Con over the last few days, which is looking like that tone is going to continue through sort of Wonder Woman and Justice League and all those sorts of movies as well.
Fun. Yeah. So. I think Margot Robbie is going to be... She just looks so cute in her little pigtails with her crazy
makeup.
Yeah,
I think she's going to be like stonking. I think she's going to storm it.
Yeah, I actually read... What was she featured in? She was featured in an article recently. I'm not sure. I think it was Vanity Fair, maybe.
Oh, the one where the bloke really wrote about her and was like, just spoke about what she looked like the whole time.
But in relation to her being Australian
and
saying that, you know, like Australia is like 20 years behind America. You've got to remember that.
Yeah.
In relation to her as an actor.
Yeah.
It's like, what are you talking about? She's fantastic, though. She went on telly in Australia and was just like, I thought it was a bit weird at the time. Like, the questions he was asking me didn't really make any sense. And then it came out and I was like, oh, that's odd.
Yeah.
And just moved on.
It shows in the write-up.
Yeah.
We'll have to tweet a link to that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We'll tweet from at Blackshaw Update because it's just terrible, terrible journalism.
Or maybe link to one of the blogs tearing it to pieces.
Yeah,
that's probably line. Yeah, actually, let's not give him any more clickbait onto his terrible article. Thank you so much, Matt, for reviewing Ghostbusters, which I will probably see soon because I haven't been to the movies for ages.
Please
feel
do.
Really bad about it.
I'll go with you and see it again.
Okay, let's do that. It's a date. Moving on, we are going to be listening to an interview that Ellie did with Lizzie Cooper, who is a stage manager and friend of Blackshaw. This is Ellie talking to Lizzie now.
Okay. Hi, I'm Ellie. I'm here with the wonderful Lizzie Cooper.
Hello.
Lizzie, tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Hello, my name's Lizzie. I am a freelance stage manager.
Where do you freelance your stage managing?
I freelance everywhere, all of the places, in London specifically. Yeah. Most recently, I am currently working on The Maids at the Trafalgar Studios.
Has it opened yet?
Yeah. We opened, when did we open? We pressed on the 29th of February. I can't remember what happened before then.
It's all a blur.
We opened one day before then. 12-week run. It's great fun.
And what do you do while the show is running? What does the stage manager do?
Well, specifically on this show, it's quite odd, but as a general, broad speaking term, we run the show. So there's three of us working on it, and one person calls the cues, all the lights and sound, and then anything that moves that's not an actor during the show, she tells it when to go. In this case, we have some blinds that move.
Is that a fly cue?
No, that's a blind cue because it flies, but we just press a button. We don't fly it, as it were.
You don't sort of manually wheel it in?
No, I expend literally no effort to do it. I just press a button.
Great.
And it goes, yeah. And we do any backstage cues. So on this show, I make a cup of tea, which is a prop that comes on stage.
Great.
But, you know, we rearrange the wings, move set, and get people in the right places, things in the right places. There's some very intricate moments of backstage where it looks like a piece of contemporary dance where we're all moving around swiftly with each other, moving big bits of set and that sort of thing.
It's very exciting. I kind of wish I could watch a show from backstage.
Yeah, there's definitely been recordings of like time-lapse videos of backstage, like running tracks of all the crew and stage management.
Are they on YouTube? Can I find those?
Probably, yeah. There's got to be some, definitely.
That's exciting.
Big operas, yeah.
So what other sort of things have you done in your career thus far?
In my career thus far? So I should have brought my CV, I'll remember.
Well, should we start chronologically? Like, where yes. did you train?
So I did an undergraduate at Royal Holloway, where I, you know, fell in love with stage management, and then...
What was the degree in?
Drama.
Okay, so broad degree.
Broad degree.
And then found your passion.
I'm just assuming knowledge because we were all there and we all did it.
You are sitting in a room of Holloway graduates, yeah. But for the benefit of all the listeners who probably aren't all Holloway graduates. Yeah. So you went to Holloway and you studied drama.
Yes.
And then what experience was it there that made you think that stage management was a thing?
Because I didn't get cast in any shows because I am not Judi Dench. We did other things and like it was a great university to experience every aspect of, you know, putting a show on because we put the shows on. There was no grown-ups there to do it for us, so all the students had to do it. And I just did stage management. Thought, oh yeah, organising stuff. I can do that. And that sort of then became a 3-year romance.
So was it right in your first year that you started doing
first
it?
First term.
That's brilliant.
I shadowed. That was it was a shadowing scheme that got me going.
That's fab.
Yeah. So I knew that I wanted to pursue it as a career. And a lot of people came out of that degree and they do other things. But I knew that I wanted to pursue it vehemently. And that's what I wanted to do when I grew up. So I had a year and I did great things. You know, I did things with Blackshaw and things with Encompass and all these like great university companies. But I knew that I'd have to take a bit of a risk. So I did a master's in stage management at Royal Welsh College of Music and Drama in Cardiff. And it was the best thing I ever did. And it was a really great investment in myself because I got brilliant training and I, you know, it cemented things that I knew about stage management and it, you know, opened doors to career options that I wasn't aware of. And we went on placements. I did a placement at the Almeida, which was the best thing ever. And then they employed me and the rest is history. And I've just been working ever since. And that was brilliant. I love the Almeida. Everyone should go and work there or go and see plays there or just go and sit in the bar.
Training and then placements jobs followed in a flow.
Yes, which I'm very lucky and very grateful for, definitely. And I'm glad I made the right move and it was a good decision to make. And I don't know what else I'd do because I'm not really sure what else I'm good at.
You spent so long training to do this now. This is your superhero.
Yeah, I've still got to stick at it for at least 15 years.
But, yeah.
So, and then I've just worked on a really, I've been very lucky. I've worked on a big variety of shows. Mm. Shakespeare's and new writing, and one show that was dubbed A Play with Songs, which was most definitely a musical.
What was that?
It was The Lorax, the Olympic, which had just been nominated for an Olivier.
Amazing! Yeah,
which is really cool. And that was probably the biggest show I've worked on thus far. And to those in the know, and I can expand, I called it, which is quite a big thing. Which meant that I was the ASM on the show, and you also book cover.
What's an ASM?
It's an ASM. Sorry, assumed knowledge. Is an assistant stage manager. So on that job, I was in the rehearsal room, but helping facilitate all of the big bits of set and sort of, you know, getting props ready and staying on top of the rehearsal room so the DSM, the deputy stage manager, could make up the book, which is what they will call the show from. So all the lights, the sound, a lot of fly cues in that. We had some flowers that popped out the stage. We had trees that flew in, and we had big fringing that came down, and that was all fun. So it was a busy show. And by the end of that show, once we moved into the theatre, I did that job and covered it, because on longer runs, the ASM will book cover as well. That's another, there's a slash next to ASM called ASM book cover. And that's what I do now generally. A lot of the shows in the West End, you always have a book cover.
Yeah.
So when people get hit by the hypothetical bus, there's always someone else that can do the job. So the show goes on.
Sure.
Yeah.
And what do you think, difficult question, is what you've most enjoyed working on?
Oh, I've enjoyed working on new shows the most.
So, and what do you mean by new shows?
So shows that are, like, they're brand new. It's it's the first time that they're happening, like, either in this country or, like, it's completely brand new. And that was great about The Lorax. Like, it was the first time we were all doing it. And that was really good fun to be in the room. Really good fun. And the maids I was in the room for as well, because if the ASM is in the rehearsal room, there's someone called the prop supervisor who goes out and does the other half of what an ASM might typically do, which is find all the props. So being in the rehearsal room is a completely different kind of vantage point on the show, because you see it happening, and it's just so exciting to be in the room while they're making that creative kind of those moments. And you sit and you're like, oh wow, that's the show, that's really cool. Also, what tends to happen is you never actually, as the ASM, get to see the show from the front. But in rehearsals you do, and you're and then suddenly you go into, once you finish rehearsals, you go into technical rehearsals, and you're in a wing, and you sort of, you sit from the side, or you see it like on a screen, and you kind of forget what happens in the show because you're busy working out what happens to make the next bit happen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really exciting being in the rehearsal room, because you see it from the front and you're like, oh yes, that's why we do it.
Is there a danger if you're not getting that rehearsal room experience that you feel a bit removed from the final performance or the final product?
Yeah, you're removed from the creative process, so you don't see how things are made. You see where they get to, because you go in and you see runs, and you might have to go into the rehearsal room and help run sections. So you do see it as it's kind of happening, you see it developing. But it's just those creative conversations. Mm. And I mean, that's not intrinsic to me doing my job, but what's great is that I will regularly go into the room when I'm propping and, you know, doing the other half of the ASM job, where you're finding everything, because you're talking to the designers and you're talking with the directors and you're working things out with the cast. So you're not removed from the show at all.
Right.
Like, you know, you don't see it being created, but it's just a different process.
Sure. And when you're propping.
Yes.
Where do you find stuff?
I mean, everywhere. I did... the Merchant of Venice at the Almeida, which was my first fully fledged like job as an ASM, and it was Rupert Gould's version set in Las Vegas that he staged at the RSC that he then restaged in the Almeida. Mm-hmm. We had some of the same cast, but it was about 50-50 split, and it was sort of like fitting an RSC shaped hole in an Almeida shaped square.
Right.
Oh, that's not right, is it?
A puzzle piece in a different hole.
So that kind of presented its own challenges. But it was all set in Las Vegas, so it would be, as you would imagine, like everything sparkly and gold and shiny and expensive. And we had some one-armed bandits, and I had...
Oh, what, like the gambling machines?
Yeah, gambling machines, which you cannot... Well, maybe someone else can find them, but I could just not find them in the UK. And I was having Skype meetings with, like... weird men in America, and like it was around Halloween as well, so like while I was like talking to them, one of them sent me like a picture of like a one-armed bandit with a pumpkin on top. It was like I've still got the email somewhere, like in the archives. So I was like, this is my job. Like, this was 2 weeks into me doing my first, like,
so bizarre
first job. we end up getting them from a place in Belgium, which is, yeah.
That's so bizarre.
Because it was the sensible option between trying to find a man in the UK that would have them, or a woman. But a person, generally, they were all men that I was speaking to. And it was like a sister company of, anyway, that's very dull, but it was a sister company of a company that they have in the UK, but it was just the Belgian version of it. And they had Old One-Arm Bandits, because they're all electronic now. They're all like fruit machines without the one arm, which is the key.
You need the lever. So,
yeah, you need the lever. And they all worked, well, they all worked when they arrived. They didn't all work by the time we sent them back, but that wasn't our fault. But they were really good fun. As a prop.
And is that probably the weirdest thing you've had to source so far?
I mean, that's probably the weirdest location. I've had to like as a team collective of stage managers, we've had to like work out how to make black blood, and that was meant to be motorbike oil, but it was blood because it came out of a bull. This was Karma Disruption at the Almeida. And we had to, like, you know, there was gravity, there was physics involved. I was very grateful that our production manager knew about volume and things like that. Every day is a new day in the world of learning how to get things and make things. Yeah.
I mean, I've often consulted you on the best recipe for things like fake beer and fake blood.
Yeah.
Which is always fun. Because there's, what is there any kind of... Insider tips you've got about things like when people are eating or drinking on stage? Is it often fake stuff, or is it the real stuff? Or
It completely depends. Like, every single show presents its kind of nuances in, like, whether or not, like, an actor can actually eat, if they want to eat something, if the director wants them to be seen to be eating something, and things like that. And very dull things like, are they allergic to nuts?
Yeah.
Or like, is anyone allergic to nuts? Because you can't have them. Like, no.
Don't rub them on your co-star.
Yeah, please do not. Like, let's not like play pea shooters with the peanuts, guys. Let's not.
Sure.
It's about getting creative with different foods to make it look like things as well. Like on the Lorax, we had this truffula fruit.
Right.
Which is, if you know the Lorax, is the fruit that falls out of truffula trees.
Of course.
Surprisingly. And the cast had to appear to be eating the insides of a truffula fruit. Now, obviously, that's not a real fruit.
No, it's not.
And it would be very silly of us to try and get someone to eat, like, wet, sticky, sweet fruit on stage in the middle of a song.
Right.
So we use marshmallows.
Oh!
Because they're the same colour. Like, and it's just finding, like, creative solutions, and that's kind of my job.
What did you have to do to the marshmallows?
Nothing. Were they just... open the bag?
Just normal marshmallows?
Just normal marshmallows. It was... So the fruit was, if you imagine, sort of... a grapefruit.
Yeah.
It wasn't an actual grapefruit, that just the size of a grapefruit. And right. Very fluffy on the outside. And it sort of opened like a book.
Yeah.
That kept together with like magnets.
Right.
Like magnets, that they were magnets.
Actual magnets.
Actual real life magnets. And it had a seed inside it, which is how you grow a truffula tree.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Science.
So it was sort of like, it had two little concave bits about egg sizes,
yeah,
and there was just like one half there was a seed and one half there was some marshmallows, and just,
that's brilliant.
Yeah, just like the tiny little marshmallows, not a big marshmallow,
sure, the mini ones for hot chocolate.
Insider top tip.
Have you had any sort of strange, unexpected things happen on the job that you can tell us about?
Strange, I mean, every day,
or just funny,
just every day. There's like things happen all the time where no one else would ever notice that anything's gone wrong. That's because, you know, like, stage managers are like, you know, spirit animal is a swan. That's
sure.
That was something that was chilled into me at drama school. And, you know, you look graceful on top, and underneath you're like pedaling away like mad to make it all seem seamless. So we had this big wagon on the Lorax, and we were in our dress rehearsal. This happened to me, so I know I can, you know, I don't mind. It's quite a funny story. And the wagon was completely dressed, but it also had some actual props in it that needed to get used. And it had a shelf on it. And the shelf had broken quite dramatically to the point where all these quite crucial props that were set in a particular way had just gone everywhere. Just everywhere. There was no, like, it had just gone like Pete Tong. Just not the one. And a cast member had come off and just said, all the knitting needles have fallen over. And the knitting needles are quite a crucial prop in the Lorax, which is how you make a thneed.
Yeah.
I feel like I should have. There should be a small podcast about the Lorax.
We'll maybe release some crib notes later.
Yeah, maybe I'll give you a picture. You can like put it on the website and people can go and find it. There's that picture's actually quite a prevalent one. It's like very long, sort of about a foot long and like an inch wide knitting needles. A very big comical prop.
Yeah,
but they're all strung together by this kind of pink elastic. Right. And there's a picture of it, and so like eight people are connected by one piece of elastic.
Yeah.
And that had all fallen down.
Right.
And it was in like a lovely little stand, sort of a bit like a test tube holder.
Right, to stop it from tangling.
To stop it from tangling and to stop it from going everywhere. Obviously, gravity was not on our side that day.
No.
So this wagon was on stage. So I'll get back to the story now. Wagon was on stage and the back end of the wagon was sort of off stage. So I had to creep it on stage during our dress rehearsal. And like we had an audience in there of like a good 200 people. And a photographer taking pictures.
No.
And like that prop was going to be used in a big dance number. So they all like go in and out each other like a big cat's cradle.
Yeah.
So they had to, like there was no way we could like just do it without or anything like that. And so I was sort of just in the back of the wagon, snuck on. My company manager was just sort of off to the side, like snuck me on, checked it was all fine. And the donkey, who's a character in the show, comes back to sort of like just have a little tinker in the wagon, sort of came in, saw me and went, I'll come back. And I was there like frantically trying to put them back in the right order because obviously they've got to come off in the line.
Yeah.
And things like that. We had like a colour-coded system. It goes in the rainbow. You know, one of the little, my little organisational tips. They all had little coloured rings on them in the order of the rainbow. So I knew which one I was looking for. But there's actually a picture floating around somewhere on the internet where the photographer takes pictures of the dress rehearsal because there's less people so they can get into all the places they want to, where there's quite obviously a shadow and everyone thinks it's the donkey, but she's not in the wagon, it's me. Is it like a comedy? That's probably one of the weirdest days I've ever had, because also that was our dress rehearsal, which was the first time. I mean, it was carnage backstage, you know, everyone's figuring out where they're going and what they're doing, we're all working together, but it's, you know, something akin to like a Pina Bausch movement piece. It wasn't, you know, like it was a piece of artwork, but.
And at that point, it's not become completely second nature, which of course it does after a little while.
Yeah, you're sort of like, okay, I'm going to have to do this now. And I think I'll be in time for my next cue and it will happen. And that's, you know, I was being a swan and it was all fine.
Yeah.
And, you know, the show went on.
That's funny.
How we laughed afterwards.
How you laughed.
Yeah. Because the cast could see me, but the audience couldn't.
Yeah.
So they could see me inside the wagon anyway.
Right.
Very funny.
What would you advise anyone who's thinking about going into stage management?
Do your research, because it's not for everyone. Mm. I know people that have, you know, spent a year interning and then suddenly decided it wasn't for them, and that's fine. That's completely fine to find out you don't like something, and it's not wrong to, you know, expend the effort to find out you don't like it, because then you know you've spent 6 months or a year doing something and you never have to do it again for the rest of your life. You know? And just do your best to get some experience and fight, like, go and try it. You know, there's so many opportunities to do, you know, get experience, go and shadow people, go and work on fringe theatre and try it. You know, if you've got the time and you can spend, you know, you can afford to do it for free sort of thing, which I did for, you know, a good year, but...
And that was before, you know, your MA, wasn't
before
it?
Yeah, before my MA, and I knew I needed to kind of spend some time getting to know the job, and doing my research. And there's a lot of books out there as well about it, which sounds ridiculous, but a lot of them are quite American. And American stage management works a lot differently to UK stage management. But you know, I did my research, and I was like, yeah, no, this is really exciting. I want to be able to tell these stories that I'm reading in these books about these shows.
And do you think that working for free for a period of time helped you to get onto your MA course?
Yeah, definitely. Like, you know, Blackshaw was like great fun. Absolutely so much fun. Because I didn't study stage management at the age of 18. I didn't have all of that knowledge. And you have to, you know, play to your strengths. If you've got time to spend 3 months, you know, around whatever else you're doing in your life, your part-time jobs, you know, all of that sort of stuff, like, it's so worth the investment in yourself, even if you're not earning any money from it, because, you know, you learn invaluable, you know, lessons doing it. And, you know, that's why I did, you know, things like Encompass, which is also another Royal Holloway graduate started group. It's much, you know, bigger now. They've got, like, in the same way Blackshaw has, it's expanded and it's great and it's evolved. But I also worked with Max and Van, who are also Holloway graduates, and it was a completely different experience.
So it's kind of getting that breadth of experience across different things and working out what it is that really drives you, I guess.
Definitely. And like Gormenghast was great because it was, you know, a story that I knew, but it was a, you know, it's a play and no one had done that before. Not in my knowledge anyway. Mm. And things like we did, like Story of Ghost Finder, all these new writings. And I was like, that's really fun because no one else has done that play before. And it's exciting. Also, they're like an hour long, which is great. Love a short show.
Don't get much of that in the West End.
No. I've actually had a run of quite short shows, actually. The show I'm working on is an hour and 50 straight through.
Is it?
I've had two of the shows that are similar like that. I've been quite lucky.
Okay. You
know? Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for an informative chat.
Thanks. I hope that's...
So much info.
I hope I've done it proud.
I think you'll be inspiring new generations of stage managers.
I hope stage managers don't listen to it and think, God, that girl knows nothing.
I think that's very unlikely. Yeah. Thanks, Lizzie. Cheers.
Thank you.
That was Lizzie Cooper talking to the lovely Ellie Pitkin, who is in the studio with right now. Beautiful interviewing Ellie.
Thanks.
Lizzie Cooper is a stage manager and fantastic.
Yes, that is a good sum up of Lizzie.
Yeah, it's a good character sort of thing I just did there.
Not assassination, opposite of assassination.
Yeah, couldn't think of the word. Didn't want to say assassination.
Birth? Character birth.
Revivification?
Revivification.
Did you just make that word up?
Maybe.
Okay. Moving on.
Okay.
Ellie's got a fun thing to tell us.
Yes. So our new writing nights have recently moved to the Hen and Chickens, mm-hmm. which is super exciting. Our first one was in July and it was fantastic. Mm-hmm. And we have got another one coming up in September, but we have changed the format of the submissions slightly. You still do it in the same way, but you do it at a different time. Mm-hmm. So the deadline, if you'd like to submit some writing for our September new writing night, is the 19th of August.
Okay.
And we are looking for any kind of new writing, as long as you've written it and it hasn't been performed as a full production elsewhere. It can be theatre or poetry or music or comedy or pretty much anything you like. A bit of a book. They're always fun.
One that you've just picked up.
No,
a bookshelf.
New writing by you. Yes. And we provide a director and actors where applicable. And it's a very exciting thing to be a part of. And there is a video telling you all about the new writing nights and how they run on our website, as well as instructions on submitting. And that is blackshawonline.com/NWN,
which stands for New Writing Night, guys.
New Writing Night. Yeah. But if you just go to the homepage, blackshawonline.com, you can navigate there real easy.
And also, if you're thinking that September sounds far away, it's not, people. It is not far away. It is near. It's August.
It's August tomorrow. Yeah.
It's terrifying.
But yeah, so the submission deadline for the writing is the 19th of August, and the acting call will go out a few days later. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember off the top of my head the deadline for that, but it's all on our website. And if you want to be the first to know about all of these sorts of things, then you should sign up to our newsletter. You can do that, again, blackshawonline.com.
Yes. So right now we are going to talk a little bit about some things that we've seen in the theatre world. Matt's going to start us off. You've been at the National pretty much consistently, it would seem, since the last show we did.
I have sort of standing appointments with the National Theatre.
Once every month or two.
Yeah.
They've got you a bed there. We all know it.
Everybody in London goes through this thing where you get here and you go to the South Bank and you think, what's that ugly building that looks like a car park? And then you go in and see plays and it's magical. And
it's listed, that building.
Yeah.
It is listed.
It's Le Corbusier.
Is it?
Yeah.
Is that why it's listed?
Yeah.
Not
famous brutalist architect. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about some shows.
We could talk about it all day.
Yeah. Shows at the Nash.
Yeah, talking about what's inside.
Okay.
Yes, what have you seen, Matt?
So I've seen two shows in the Littleton space, which is its sort of a slightly, probably its most kind of standard space. It's kind of an end-on black box studio theatre. A couple of classics. So The Deep Blue Sea by Terence Rattigan. We're starring Helen McCrory this time around.
Who I love.
She's so good in it, but did you ever doubt that?
No, she's good in everything.
I'm
jealous of Damien Lewis because he's married to her. Normally it's the other way around, right?
I feel like this show has got a lot of girl crushes coming from your side.
Yeah.
You just get this wry little smile on your face when you talk about a lady you really like. It's kind of creepy.
I'm sorry. Carry on, Matt.
And so the other show is the Plough and the Stars, which is a Sean O'Casey Irish tragicomedy about the set in 1916 about the Easter Rising, also in the same space.
Mm-hmm. With what did you say then? The Easter Rising.
The Easter Rising, yeah.
Like the Easter is in the holiday.
As in, it happened around the holiday. Yes, I'm afraid my history is a little bit shaky.
Okay.
They don't tend to teach you the details of Irish rebellions in English schools, for one reason and another.
Easter Rising. So it was a rebellion.
It was a rebellion. The people rose.
I'm assuming
against the English. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So I was picturing Easter. So a lot like bunnies and eggs rising, the sun.
No.
In my head, that's what I thought.
Much more. Dublin tenement buildings and squalor and shells and soldiers.
Definitely no bunnies.
No. Okey-dokey. But still funny.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think it's probably the play with the biggest cast of Sean O'Casey's oeuvre.
Really?
I've studied a couple of his plays, which are quite kind of very tight, like all set in one room, like three or four characters, very sort of... potboilery, and this is a bit more of a sort of big sprawling sort of history play, which is very, very engaging. But again, very sad at the end. Both plays very sad.
That's what you were saying. So we were going to talk a little bit about plays making you upset.
Yeah,
and both of these plays did
giving you a sort of strong emotional reaction. Yeah.
Okay, not upset. Then we won't go with upset.
Yeah, I mean that's what these two have in common. Like sort of left with that. Proper sort of theatrical catharsis feeling of having felt something really strong and it not necessarily being a nice emotion, but you kind of coming out feeling more sort of level and cleansed for having felt it.
Okay, that's interesting.
Which is sort of a really powerful thing that theatre can do.
Theatre making you feel all the feels.
Yeah, definitely.
Very good. So that's the Deep Blue Sea.
Yeah.
Which is playing at the National up until the 21st of September, I believe. And then The Plough and the Stars is at the Irish one.
It is.
Yes, and that's playing all the way up until October. So they're both quite long running.
Yeah.
Which one did you prefer the most? That's probably a very difficult question. Sorry.
Because they're sort of very different in terms of sort of their tone and sort of the sort of people that they... the people that they focus on. So The Plough and the Stars is very much about like the sort of the working class, and the Deep Blue Sea is much more sort of about sort of much more of a kind of middle class drawing room sort of scenario.
Right.
So I don't know. I don't think I can pick a favourite.
Okay,
really.
That's fine. That's acceptable.
But you'd recommend them both?
I would recommend them both, yeah. I think they're both really strong.
On the complete other end of the spectrum, as I said at the top of the show, I went and saw Matilda. I took my Australian parents to it. Loved it. Didn't think that I was going to love it as much as I did. Because remember I was saying like a couple of weeks ago that I don't really do musical theatre.
Mm-hmm.
And I was slightly worried that I might get in there and be like, I hate this.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't not like it, you know? There were so many kids there. It was insane.
I think it's a fantastic introduction to theatre.
Oh, yeah. But because it was height of summer in London,
school
holidays, they were crawling everywhere. No, like, seriously, the whole place was moving, the children, like, at all times. And so,
that
amazing.
That makes it really good to watch, though. Presumably they were quiet during the show.
Here and there. We were... next to some particular... I don't really like children anyway. just to let you know.
But what did you about the show?
The music was insane.
Tim
and
Minchin.
It was so Tim Minchin.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I was quite interested about before I went, was trying to figure out how that was going to go. And because everyone that I've spoken to has said, oh my God, it's so Tim Minchin. And I was like, how? How can it be... like, how can you just... how can it be like that?
Because he's filthy a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And this is a kids' show, family
but
show.
But also, he's so lyrically clever.
Yeah.
And I think some of it, we were actually in the upper circle, so I'm not sure if that had anything to do with it. But because he is so lyrical and he uses quite large words, as you probably wouldn't normally in musical theatre, I found some of it got a little bit lost.
Mm-hmm.
But because they repeat the choruses and everything so much, you sort of get it towards the end of the song anyway. But I thought that was really interesting that he kept that up the whole way through. And as I know his stuff, it was interesting to see that the show really revolved around wordiness.
Yeah.
Well, and also because it's Roald Dahl.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, that connects really well with the original material, which is obviously writing by Roald Dahl, and it's a literary play, a literary book. It's about literature and love of words and reading and writing.
Yeah, yeah. I thought all the performances were incredible. The children, I mean, I can't even talk about them without getting emotional because they were just the little dark kids. Like, there was this kid with a huge afro who was probably a foot tall, and he was just the most gorgeous little thing I've ever seen in my life. Like, it just blew my mind. And all of the adults' performances were fantastic as well. There was not a bad person in it. And yeah, it was so uplifting. It was just like, you came out and you were just like, oh God, I'm so happy. I feel so happy. And the swings, the set was just brilliant.
The set is incredible. It's very innovative.
And also the amount of physical acting they're doing, jumping around, trampoline stuff, swinging about.
Yeah, it's actually quite stylized, a lot of it.
Yeah, and like, you know, the kids are up on the desks, and every time they sort of got up on something high, I was like, oh, don't fall, please. Don't want to see you break your leg. But like, they're just, they really, yeah, the energy was insane. So
I
actually
saw the other week, the designer's original sort of model of the stage set and what it was going to look like is in the theatre and performance part of the Victoria and Albert Museum.
Oh, is it?
So that's cool. If you can't get tickets for the show, I wouldn't say it's the next best thing, but
but it's interesting.
Buy the soundtrack and then go there and look at
listen
the tiny...
to the soundtrack while looking at the model box.
And you get a taste of the experience.
Yeah, that's really sad. Don't do that.
But you can get, I mean, obviously a lot of the tickets for Matilda can be quite expensive, but you can get standby tickets on the day for about £15, I think, which for West End is very, very reasonable.
Very reasonable. The next thing that we're going to do is back by popular demand. Obviously, the Edinburgh Fringe is beginning this Friday on the 5th.
It's come around so fast.
So fast.
Really has. So if you were listening to the show a couple of weeks ago, we did the first ever edition of Edinburgh Fringe Roulette, which no one has ever done before, I'm going to say.
Probably.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Where we read out random listings from the Edinburgh Fringe programme.
Yes. We have moved on, though, in terms of technology, as we have an app now.
We do, yes. The Edinburgh Fringe 2016 catalogue and booking mobile app is out now, which it wasn't last time we were doing the show. So instead of riffling through pages and sticking our fingers on listings, we are going to put random words into the search bar of the app.
Which could fail miserably, but let's hope for the best.
Okay.
All right, who wants to go first?
Me.
Have you got a pre-prepared?
Well volunteered.
Yeah. So whenever I think of random words, they are always foodstuffs.
Okay.
So I'm going to go with jam.
Okay, jam. And are we going to do first listing generally or first listing in a category?
I think just the first one that comes up.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, first listing that comes up when you put jam into the bar is called Saxo Classico.
That has not got the word jam in it.
That's confusing.
The title does not, but the description, I believe, does.
Ah, okay.
Right.
Yeah, it searches everything.
Sure, I get it.
It sees all.
That's a good search option, I think. Like, you know, thorough.
Yeah. Do you want to read the description or shall I?
No, you can do it.
Okay.
Surprise me.
Infectious energy observer, an exceptional saxophonist, Saxophone Journal. Some more quotes. This duo of Salsa Celtica and Delphian Records explores the richness of classical music for saxophone and piano by composers from Scotland and Latin America.
Okay, music.
Oh, now I expected that description to have the word jam in it somewhere. I expected it to say they jam on their saxophones. I can't actually. Oh, I know what it is.
Is it a tag?
It mentions somebody called James.
This is not going well.
No, I think this is perfect. It's giving us that completely random.
It's more random than the word.
It's more random than we ever anticipated.
I've thought of my word.
Okay, what word would
it's
you like?
It's also food related.
Okay.
It's cheese.
Cheese.
Because I feel like that's not going to be a named person.
Okay.
Unless someone is awesomely called cheese.
All right. The first result for cheese is musical again. Would you like that or shall we...
No, we've had a music already.
Okay, do you want theatre or comedy? Oh, please, can we do theatre?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, Ellie, do you want to take this one?
Okay, cool. So this is a show called Go to Hell, Jesus. After the rapture and his second coming to earth, Jesus Christ finds himself transported to hell. Confused and disorientated, Jesus must find his way through the depths of the underworld to get to the bottom of what is a seemingly rather catastrophic clerical error. Only with the help of his companion, Beelzebub, demoted for borderline sexually assault on a co-worker, can he prevail over the comedic perils and old arch-enemies of the underworld and return to heaven, which means he must confront the big cheese of hell himself, Satan.
There it is. I'm slightly disappointed that it wasn't actual cheese.
No, but that sounds fun, and I like the phrase big cheese. It looks like an amusing poster. It's eligible for the 2-for-1 Friends discount, which That's is good. Brilliant. It's at the Space at Surgeons Hall, which is venue 53, August the 8th to the 13th and 15th to the 18th. So
good times. It's on a lot.
Yeah.
Suitable for 14 plus only.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
Expect some mild peril.
And maybe some swearsies.
Probably by the sound of that little summary. Probably lots of swearing.
Maybe. Yeah.
Should we do one more?
Okay.
Matt, you get to choose a word this time.
I'm going to search for the word tree.
Tree, okay.
Tree.
Interesting.
Nature.
The most drama word, because that's everybody's recollection of drama, even if they've never been in a real play, is pretending to be a tree at school. Yeah.
Do people still actually do, is that a thing?
No.
Oh, okay, fine. I don't know.
Apart from your husband did once play a Christmas tree.
Of course he did.
Not even at school.
No.
higher learning, that
he paid to play a Christmas tree.
No, it was at university. So yes, he did pay to play.
Yeah.
Okay, so first listing for tree is in the theatre category, and it is called Cosmic Fear or The Day Brad Pitt Got Paranoia.
Okay. Sorry,
I nearly said amnesia. Alrighty, yeah.
Is it because you've got amnesia?
It's playing at the Bedlam Theatre, and the description says, LA is filled with traffic jams under heavy smog. Trees are drifting under floods in Bangladesh and in China. Incinerators are burning holes in the ozone layer. Brad fears the future. Brad is a man of action and he's not here to entertain but to make a difference. Brad embarks on the great universal love project to save planet Earth. Can the ultimate blockbuster be made to transform the consciousness of the entire world before it's too late?
Oh my goodness, that seems very involved. Is someone actually playing Brad Pitt as well?
Well, the
that's setting itself up, but it's for
the
disaster.
Image that the company have supplied for their listing is a man with a rabbit head.
Okie dokie.
So maybe Brad Pitt's face is never revealed.
It might be that.
Maybe he's a human rabbit man.
Yeah.
Okay, that sounds
it sounds ambitious.
Yeah, it's down under theatre brackets new writing multimedia.
Okay. Ooh. That sounds kind of fun, actually.
I'm kind of surprised it didn't come up under the jam search, because it has the word jams in it, which is closer to jam than James.
Are you feeling robbed?
Something is going on with their algorithms on the Edinburgh Fringe app.
They knew we wanted it to be truly random. So.
If you have technical problems with the search function of the Edinburgh Fringe app, please do not address them to us.
No.
We've only highlighted the issue. We're not taking stock of it.
Please tweet to at Ed Fringe on Twitter, not at Blackshore Update.
So that was the innovation of the Edinburgh Fringe roulette that we've pioneered
once
here.
Once again, revealing the completely weird variety of fringe shows.
Yes,
everything
incredible
is there.
Range.
And if you're going to see any ridiculous, weird fringe shows, then tweet us and tell us about the ones that you're going to see.
Yeah.
Or after you see them.
Afterwards would be great. If you can tweet us at Blackshore Update and use the hashtag seen it, take a photo of your ticket and give us a short Twitter length review, then we would love to know what you think of what's up there.
Yes,
if you really sell it, I might even then go and see it.
See,
and then
we
could
with Matt.
We could review it again.
I'm going to be up there week three, so you've got some time to
sway right. Me. We're sending you up there with the microphone to be our roving reporter. Very exciting. Stay tuned for the next couple of shows on the Blackshore Arts Hour, because Matt's going to be talking about Edinburgh Fringe stuff. That takes us to the end of the show, guys. We're done for another week. No, don't be too sad.
I feel like we've been talking about heightened emotions today. So
yeah, everyone's feeling pretty emotional.
Crushed. I'm feeling crushed.
Okay.
We're back in 2 weeks. It's not all bad. Yeah.
And on that note, Matt will be reviewing Suicide Squad in 2 weeks if you would like to tune in for that. We're also a podcast as well. So if you haven't been listening live to us tonight, then you can download us and have us on your device.
Yes, you can subscribe. We are all over all of the stores where you can get those downloady things. Just search for the Blackshore Arts Hour.
Yes, and don't forget to submit your new writing by the 19th of August for our new writing night in September. We'll be back with you in a fortnight's time. Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Ellie. And that's the Blackshire Arts Hour for another week.
Good night.
Bye, guys.
Bye.